I think especially for mothers, we have a lot of ideas about what we should be doing. Not what we want to be doing or what would be best for our families or ourselves, like what the culture wants us to do. And I think we would all do better, and I think this is anyone who is a parent of any child of any age, to say, is this something that I am expected to do? Or is this something that actually aligns with my values and what I hope to have, the relationships that I hope to have with my family members? That's my whole kind of philosophy on all relationships.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bite Your Tongue, the podcast. Join me, your host, Denise Gorant, as we explore the ins and outs of building healthy relationships with our adult children. Together, we'll speak with experts, share heartfelt stories, and get timely advice, addressing topics that matter most to you. Get ready to dive deep and learn to build and nurture deep connections with our adult children. And of course, when to bite our tongues. So let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Bite Your Tongue, the podcast. You know, over our hiatus, we were working so hard to get some great guests, and today's guest is one of our best. But before we start, I'd like to remind all of you, I have to say it at the beginning because it's important, help support our podcast. Just visit our website, biteyourtonguepodcast.com. Click on the Support Us tab. For only $5, you can buy us a virtual cup of coffee. Can I ask all of you to do that today? You have no idea how much just $5 will help us. So let's get started. I'm thrilled to welcome Jessica Gross to Bite Your Tongue today. If you've not heard her name, maybe you've read some of her work, or at least you will definitely read her work after listening today. She's a young adult, insightful, and a great writer. She's an opinion writer at the New York Times, writing quite a lot on parenting and millennials, among other things. Her most recent book, Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood, is a wonderful overview of motherhood in America. The San Francisco Chronicle wrote, "If this book feels like it's sounding the alarm on the state of American motherhood, well, that's because it is." But today, I'm also excited because Jessica's a young adult. She's a parent, but also a young daughter to parents like us. She wrote a New York Times article several years ago that caught my attention. It was called, "Your Mom is Destined to Annoy You, How to Manage Your Inevitable Holiday Regression." And then after the height of COVID, when folks started traveling again, she wrote an article titled, "The Return of the Holiday Agita." So welcome, Jess. We're so excited to chat with you today. I want to remind you first that our listeners are parents. We're mostly 50 plus, so this is going to be a little different than a lot of your other interviews, of which I know there are many, and I've listened to many. But before I get into my questions, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into sort of writing about parenting. I know you're not exclusively parenting now. I read a lot of your opinion columns. I think you did one on movies and TV lately. There's one, I'll talk about a lot of those towards the end. You talk about everything now, but you've leaned into parenting a lot. How did you get here?
Not intentionally. I always say, I don't ever have a 5-year plan. I think if you are in creative work, it can be really kind of deadening to really plan things out too precisely. But, you know, I always wanted to write. I always wanted to be a journalist. Fresh out of college, started working for a music magazine. And then I worked for a food publication and food and restaurants. And then after that, I worked at Jezebel, which was, you know, is a women's website, started in 2007. And I was there the first couple years it was around. And then I worked at Slate, and then I was freelance, and I wrote a couple books along the way, and I worked for a startup. And then I came to the Times in 2018, and when I came to the Times, that was when I started focusing on parenting, because I was brought on to start a parenting product section, whatever you want to call it.
Did they suggest that to you, or was that of interest to you, or both?
Yeah, that was, you know, that was the job that I applied for. And I, you know, obviously was interested in the subject matter, but it was more an opportunity to build something knew that was sort of had the energy of a startup, but was in a bigger corporation. So there was more stability. So certainly the subject matter always interested me. And even before I became a parent myself, I think so many things are at the intersection of family life. I mean, obviously raising the next generation, there's politics, there's sociology, there's history. I think it's just a really rich subject that I think is often diminished or minimized because it's looked at in a rather narrow way. It's so much more than just, oh, you know, buy this new bassinet, which I think is like, it's often minimized to this very narrow thing and only focused on very young babies and children and the entrance into parenthood, whereas it's everything.
It's everything, and it doesn't stop. And we're going to talk about that today.
Yeah.
But I would say it's not bassinets. It's buy this thing to get your kid to sleep. There's more about sleep than anything else. Anyway, I'm going to separate this discussion into two parts. We're going to start first talking about your new book. It's very cool, called Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of American Motherhood. And the second part, I want to talk about a couple of the articles that you wrote that really are exactly towards my audience. I love the title of your book, Screaming on the Inside, mostly because I think even parents of adults are screaming on the inside even more now because we're busy biting our tongues. So tell me how you came up with that title. Where did that come from?
So that was actually my agent's idea, because I wanted a title that was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but that also expressed the fact that a lot of these feelings are internal and they're normal, and having ambivalent or sometimes negative feelings about your role as a parent, people have always felt this way. And expressing them on the outside is often what is the problem, because I think we're told, I think especially as mothers, that we should only ever have express perfect joy and perfect love for our children. Whereas, you know, anyone who's done it for more than 30 seconds knows that that's not realistic and not how anyone can get through the day. And so I wanted a title that sort of expressed that. And also, there's a lot of history in the book. I sort of have an orientation towards the subject matter that, like, yes, some things are new in terms of technology and social media, but I think a lot of the emotions and feelings around parenting and motherhood are eternal. And actually, I'm going to read you a quote that I keep on my desktop, because it just makes me remember that there is nothing new under the sun. And this is from a New York Times parenting column that I believe was written in the 40s or 50s, maybe even earlier. It was definitely long before I was born. All the same, he thinks that the problems of our time are probably not more vexing to us than the problems of 50 or 100 years ago were to earlier generations, who also had to live with things as they found them. Dr. Lowry contributes this thought for the week to fathers and mothers who think that life was never so complex as now. The world is going to the dogs. The children no longer obey their parents. Elders no longer obey the laws. People are losing their respect for the church. Immorality is rife. The world is going to the dogs. This is a free rendering of a Babylonian cuneiform inscription over 6,000 years ago.
That's really amazing. It's almost like it's written today. The only thing missing is social media.
Yes.
You know, my next question, I want you to talk a little bit about this history. Your book does lead to some things that are, well, we think are more difficult now. When you think of that quote, you think, well, maybe nothing's more difficult. Maybe they're not more difficult. They're different.
So I have this line in the book also. It's just all of these things are just shape-shifting. So yes, they have different trappings because life changes. I think one thing obviously that has changed a lot in the past, you know, 50 to 100 years is more women working outside the home, which is different, although not historically necessarily unprecedented in terms of mothers have always worked. When we lived in a more agrarian culture, all they did was work. There was farm work. So, I mean, I think we had these ideas of, oh, mothers don't work. That's just historically inaccurate. It just looks different, but the essential emotions and the fears and love and feelings that we have about our children, those are eternal.
Okay, so I'm going to skip that part because I really think you've summed it up. And in your book, you go into quite in depth about the history. So people that are interested should really grab the book.
because it's quite interesting. Is there anything you want to say about the history we haven't covered, sort of? I mean, I think you've summed it up in what I wanted, but is there anything I've missed?
I don't think so. I mean, honestly, what I love about the history is just a reminder that people have always struggled, and it always comforted me. I actually found the history and researching it for my book one of the most exciting parts, because you can really feel a kinship to mothers going through the same things that we went, you know, that you know, we may be going through. And so I found it very comforting.
I remember, I mean, I'm old enough to remember when the television was coming out, we were getting them in our homes and people were saying it's the demise of the American family, you know, so it's a similar kind of thing. All these different things sort of people, you know, slammed or whatever.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's move on. Also, your book brings up lots of political issues, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from my viewpoint, probably what I think is one of the most critical issues is decent and affordable childcare. The children seem to take a back seat these days. Do you agree, or what would you say stands out as one of the most critical issues that we all need to really work on? I know there's hundreds, so I'm asking you to bring one or two to the top.
You know, the more I think about it, I think the number one thing that would help parents, but it would actually help everybody, is universal healthcare.
Interesting.
I say that because so much of childcare and the issues around it are because parents cannot take flexible jobs. And why can't they take flexible jobs? Well, they're afraid of losing their health insurance. I think we would have much more flexibility in terms of the kind of care. We have a very inelastic childcare resource amount of, you know, that we don't have enough resources, full stop. Obviously, there are not enough childcare providers. It is too expensive. The answer right now, the only answer we have, is that everybody work more. And I think there would be more ability for people to have solutions and for less coverage overall to be necessary if parents could be more flexible in their work hours, which we just cannot have at this point, because you need to work a certain amount of hours to have health insurance. And it would also solve, we have a maternal mortality crisis. And part of that crisis is because there is not adequate maternity care. And there's not definitely extremely inadequate postpartum care. Again, all of these issues are so systemic. And whenever I think about what is the number one thing that I actually think would help the most people, including and especially parents, universal healthcare.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true, I think. But you're right. Universal healthcare is tangled into every other one.
Exactly. We don't think of it that way. But it's just, I mean, I think of it in my own life, where my husband and I both have full-time staff jobs. And part of the reason we do that is because I'm very risk averse. And I love my job. I'm not about to give it up. But like, we both feel right now in our lives pretty darn exhausted, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. And we have, our kids aren't even that little anymore. They're 7 and 10, but there are just too many things every day for all of us to do. If one of us could work fewer hours, or both of us could work fewer hours and not worry about not being able to have catastrophic health coverage, it would be life-changing. And we are so privileged, you know?
Well, that's what I'm saying. There's such a huge socioeconomic difference in so many families. You know, it's hard to really, I'm not saying this right. You continue, because I'm not saying it right.
No. You really are. You are. I mean, that's the thing about universal healthcare. It's like there was just an article in the Times about how even upper middle class families in New York City are struggling to afford care because it is so expensive. We need more subsidized care kind of for everyone. But I think, again, it is such a big problem that it would be good to have more levers to pull. And right now, parents working less, which I think a lot of parents would prefer to do, especially when their kids are little, that's not a lever we can pull. We don't have the ability to pull that because they need housing. Again, everything is sort of all intertwined.
You know, it's interesting that you say when they're little, because I always really was a believer in a lot of my friends. I mean, we're all parents of adult kids. Anyone can change a diaper. Anyone can take them to the zoo. when you want to be around is when they turn about 13. There's some truth to that, that it's your joy you're missing when they're young, really.
Mm-hmm.
When you want to really know what's going on is when they hit about 13. And a lot of parents start going back to work more when they hit 13 because they can.
That makes sense. That really makes sense.
From my vantage point, I'm so glad you're pushing for all this because we've come a long way. I mean, when my kids were born, there wasn't parental leave at all. And now all of us are looking at our kids. And again, it's a higher socioeconomic level, higher, you know, jobs with full staff, all of that. Some of these young men are getting 4 to 6 months off. That just seems crazy to us. And yet it's wonderful.
I never, ever want to diminish the fact that we have come so far in such a short period of time. I mean, I remember in the book, I interview a historian who I believe is in her 80s. And I was talking to her on this day where I was like, nothing's ever going to change. It feels like we've been stuck in the same conversation for 30 years. And she was like, you know, the first job that I had to sign something that I said I would agree to quit if I got pregnant and was showing. So I just always want to be appreciative of the progress that we've made. And I think all the time about how, you know, when my parents got married in 1972, my mother couldn't have gotten a credit card on her own, which is just completely baffling to think about. And so certainly things are so much better than they used to be. And I'm deeply appreciative of all the people, particularly women who fought these battles before me, because they were real battles. No one was giving this to anybody out of the kindness of their heart.
And speaking of your parents, they're both doctors. How did they deal with raising you? I mean, do you have siblings? Is it just you?
I have an older brother.
And how did they manage, do you think, back in their day?
So, you know, I think that in a weird way, when I talked to my mom, I think in some ways it was easier for her only because she didn't feel guilty. I think she had that feeling of like, I'm fighting for this. She didn't have time to feel guilty. She was one of five women in her medical school class. She really was. It was unusual when she was in medical school from 1970 to 1974. At the time, there just were not many female doctors. And so I think she didn't really spend a lot of time worrying about, oh, am I spending enough time with the kids? And this and that. The other thing that I think I definitely feel sort of more guilt than she did, which is kind of interesting. My dad was really, I think, unusually involved for a man of his generation. He really did a lot of the childcare. They really were a partnership in a way that I really admire and I think was inspiring as I made my own family. But they were definitely constructed their lives to be pretty involved. They obviously had the privilege to have control over their schedules, at least some control, definitely not total control. But, you know, my dad was a super early riser, still an early riser to this day. So he'd always take the first shifts in the morning. So he was gone before we woke up. But that meant that he was often regularly home for the day by 4 p.m. And he would come to our sports games and, you know, be home for dinner. And my mom, she ran a psych ward at a local hospital for a while. And then actually, kind of exactly what you say, when we were getting older, she wanted to be home more and have more time for us. And so she moved into a private practice and she had a home office. She was really around. I feel like they showed me how to have a pretty good balance of career and home and still being sort of very highly involved in our lives.
Interesting. They were trailblazers, although I guess, you know, they're older than me and much younger than my parents. So hard for me to relate completely.
Yes.
And I know right now your parents help with your childcare. Is that right?
Not as much anymore. They did during the pandemic. We moved in with them so that we could work in 2020. And that was actually really lovely in a lot of ways. We see them once a week. They come for dinner on Sundays and it's great. So our kids have such a really strong relationship with them.
That's great.
When they were babies, they would watch them on Fridays. So before they were in preschool, when they were like little. They're so close to my kids. It's so special.
How about your spouse's parents? Are they as close?
They are. They have a geographic disadvantage. That's... So actually, they were just here last night and our kids love spending time with them, but they live in California.
Yeah, there's been a lot written about. In fact, there was a recent article, maybe it was the New York Times, about the grandparent effect or something, when families live together with the grandparents, what an effect it has on the kids.
Yes.
So many parents of my generation are literally moving geographically across states, you know, across the country to be closer to their kids when their kids have kids, mainly for childcare. What else can our generation understand about your generation, and how can we be more supportive of our adult children in this whole young parenting arena?
So I would say, it's complicated. It's hard because it's like, I would say I always pretty much agreed with my mom and looked to her for advice about child stuff, you know, so it's never been a source of tension in my family, but I understand that many people do find this to be a source of tension. And there's a lot of disagreements about choices that may be made. And I mean, I love the title of your podcast. I think often if you are not concerned that a child is in danger, you just got to bite your tongue. Mm-hmm.
Do you think your mom does that? Or do you think you're accepting of whatever she says?
I'm sure she bites her tongue a lot. She wouldn't tell me. You know, I mean, I'm sure.
Okay.
I'm,
right. No, usually we don't. Usually we don't. We just bite our tongues.
Yeah.
Tongues.
I mean, I would say I'm sure there's small, I would say like, I'm sure there's low stakes things that she sees me do that she is like, well, that's not how I would have done it. But in general, on the like broad strokes, I know that she feels that I'm doing a good job. And that means something to me.
It means a lot to you.
Yeah, it means a ton to me. And I think that's the thing. It's like, you have to look at the big picture. The little things day to day, like kids can be raised and thrive in a multitude of circumstances. So unless you think your kid is making a disastrous mistake and really harming their family, their children, it's not worth it. It's not worth it to damage the relationship.
Absolutely.
And my mom and I also have, I think one of the nice things about our whole family relationship is we're able to joke with each other. They'll make fun of certain things about me and it's all, you know, I'll make fun of them. And I think it's like, you know, there's maybe is mildly hostile. It's a way to blow off steam for everyone that I actually think is pretty healthy. So, you know, I don't think that we have a particularly tense relationship. We joke around a lot. They have a very jokey, warm relationship with my kids. One thing that we joke about that I think some people could be very sensitive about, we all just joke about, my kids watch a fair bit of TV. I watched a ton of TV growing up. Like, they let me watch tons of TV. So we all joke about we're letting the kids watch too much TV. You know what? I turned out fine. So that's just sort of an example where someone think depending on the dynamic of their relationships with their parents might be offended by that. But we're joking about it. And it's not, it is what it is.
And I don't know if I have any empirical evidence, but a lot of people I know that are very bright and have done very well will tell me they watched a lot of TV.
There's not great research on this because often kids who watch a ton of TV, you don't know what else is going on. There's a lot of confounding factors, right?
Right.
The question I always ask about these things, okay, what is this behavior replacing? If my kids only watch TV and they didn't also read all the time and were physically active and had friends, I'm not worried about it because they both read a ton. Their homework's done. They're playing outside. Do I occasionally feel guilty about it, especially if it's like a rainy Saturday and nobody's left the house for hours and we're all in our screens? You know, that's not ideal, but you just need to look at the holistic picture of your kids. And I think you should think about that in kind of everything. I think a lot of parents get really worked up about what their kids are eating. That's sort of another example.
Another big thing.
You have to look at the whole picture of the week.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but everything you're saying sounds like someone from my generation talking.
I don't know. I'm like out of step.
You are really out of step.
I think, honestly, part of it is because I report in this field. I talk to so many people who are driving themselves absolutely to distraction over every little thing. And because I am so steeped in the research, I know that you just don't have that much control. You cannot control absolutely every little thing. You need the big picture things, which is stability, enough food to eat, being warm and loving, and hoping you can just hope for the best and having expectations of behavior that are reasonable and having structure. Like the one thing that I am very anal about is structure. My kids have a predictable structure to every single day.
I was just like that, Jessica. My friends thought I was crazy.
They need that. They want that. That they want to know what is happening for them at a certain time. You know, I have stock phrases that I say to the kids that drive them absolutely. They make fun of me for them, but it's
okay. What are they? You've got to
share them. One that it's like when they complain about their teachers or, you know, kids at school that they don't like, I always say learning to deal with people that you don't care for is an important life skill. So they,
absolutely.
You're not going to like, you got to learn to get along with people you don't like.
Right.
So that's one that my older daughter has been making fun of me about a lot. The one that my younger daughter makes fun of me is, I think I only said this once, but it stuck with her. If you're early, you're on time. If you're on time, you're late. If you're late, don't bother. I don't like wasting people's time. I think,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm just like that. My husband is always late and it drives me out of my mind.
I have trained them very well. They like, my husband can be, he's not late, but he just wants to be regular on time. And my girls now mm-hmm. will just like nag him. They're like, no, we got to get out of here.
Well, you're lucky. I tried my best. Anyway, okay, we need to move on here. I want to talk about, you write in your book that no one wants to admit they're struggling. And you kind of talked about this in the minute, screaming on the inside. Everyone wants to be the model parent. Social media comes into play. You know, that doesn't change when your kids become adults. Everyone holds in the struggles that they're having. You were around your, as I'm sure you know, as a young parent, you have a lot of friends, parents of other kids your kids go to school with. Okay, they move on. You see them later. You're going to want to say, Sally's doing great, even if she's a drug addict.
Right.
I mean, I hate to say that.
That's true.
How do we deal with this? Is there any answer to this? How do we handle the guilt or the screaming on the inside, I guess?
Well, I mean, to me, I think it's the biggest thing that has helped me is having close confidant. So I have friends that I really depend on. I can be completely honest with them and feel that I am not being judged. I think those people are hard to come by. They don't just grow on trees. And that has been so sustaining for me. But I also find reading, I am actually really deep into this incredibly long biography of Sylvia Plath that came out in 2020.
Oh my gosh.
And for me, just reading all of these histories of women who have been through, if not identical things, but dealt with some of the same issues. I don't know. It just, I find it, you know, listen, I don't want the ending that Sylvia Plath had.
No, you don't.
But at the same time, I think there can be validation. And just understanding that everybody has struggles. Things don't always turn out. It's not a moral judgment on you.
I think you're right. We all have to be more open. You're right. And I think the confidence I think you'll find change throughout your life. Well, not completely. I still have some from high school, but they go around. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
As we all were raising our kids, we were different geographically, didn't share as much. We're back now to sharing more. You know, it's interesting. So you're right. All right, before we close on the book, Screaming on the Inside, is there anything I missed?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
Okay, what compelled you to write, Your Mom is Destined to Annoy You, How to Manage Your Inevitable Holiday Regression?
It was before Thanksgiving. I think I've gotten better about it in the past couple of years. There just was always this moment where my mom is usually my mom. She wouldn't even be doing anything wrong. And she would just be getting on my last nerve. And it wasn't fair to her. And it wasn't that fun for me. And I think it's become honestly easier since I've had kids, because it's like I see how my middle schooler gets annoyed by me in the exact same way I get annoyed by my mother.
Well, I bring that up later. I actually bring that up. I'm going to bring it up right now. In your podcast, when you were interviewed with Christina P, I guess she's a comedian.
Yes, yes.
I don't know her. She just goes by Christina P. Anyway, I love that interview. Anyone listening, you should listen to it. You talked about looking for a pair of pants for your daughter. She said she wanted them. You got them and she was not happy about it. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, that's exactly what happens as the parent of adult child. You knock yourself out. trying to find the right thing and you buy the wrong thing or it doesn't fit or whatever. And you feel bad about it. You get shot down. So it never stops. Yeah. What was your reaction to your daughter when she said
that? Oh, I laughed. It was hilarious. Like she was like, because she totally insulted me.
Right. Exactly. She didn't bite her tongue.
Yeah. But we have like, I'm very, very hard to offend. And so I just she had a really good insult delivery. And so I just laughed. Like, I just think it's the only way to deal. Like she's funny. So she was like, these look like something you would wear. And I was like, it's a sick burn. That's really like, I'm because, you know, I always feel like I'm the adult. You gotta have a thick skin, I think, to be a parent. And so I laughed and I was like, right. That was so rude. And she laughed and it was just like, you know, I can't actually remember anything that my kids have ever said that has actually hurt my feelings because they're not in general saying they're not at the point, I guess they're not teenagers yet. So I won't be surprised if it does happen when they do eventually say things that are meant to hurt my feelings. But at least up till now, and they're sweethearts. They're very empathetic kids and I'm very proud.
They're at great ages.
Yes.
You're at fun, fun ages. Most parents at your stage in parenting do have a thick skin. And I think even through the teens, your skin stays thick because you have to. I think it really does become really hard when they're young adults and you've given all of this and suddenly everything you say is criticized. We're politically incorrect 95% of the time, even though we try really hard to say it all correctly. We're biting our tongues. Do you think your mother ever felt that when you came home for the holidays and were struggling with her? Or did she never show any, like, Jessica, I'm trying my best here?
Oh, I'm sure she did. I think there were definitely, especially when I was in college, when mm-hmm. I was wanting individuation, wanting independence. And I think I can't remember the details, but I'm sure, you know, there were some struggles, but I think not for a long time. I'm sure she felt that. But I do think, you know, she's a retired psychiatrist. And so I think,
oh, that's right.
Yeah. We've always had a language to kind of talk about our feelings in a way that has felt productive. It doesn't mean nobody does, like, that feelings are never hurt or egos are never bruised, but I think it's helped given us sort of the language and the way to relate to each other. But, and I think especially, you know, since I've become a mother, I mean, I have said to her recently, as my older daughter is getting into that tween, teen, you know.
These pants look like something you would buy or you would wear.
No, it's not. That doesn't bother me so much. What I find hard is she will burst into tears over her hair not looking good. And it's 7 in the morning and I'm not awake yet. And I'm just like, how did you not kill me when I So it's more of that. It's like not even negative. It's starting the morning with like just a big emotional outburst. Even if it's like, I'm not mad at her. It's just, it's a lot to deal with before 8 a.m., man. Like I'm not built for that. So that I feel like she and I can have a laugh now about, I am very much like my older daughter. I know I was the exact same way at her age. And we can sort of have a laugh about that together now.
Right. Well, the laughing sounds really a great part of your family.
Yeah, it really is.
In this article, you talk about regression and you actually provide a scientific term for it. Family systems theory. Tell us about it.
So, I mean, each family is its own sort of closed loop in a way. It's like your role in that family and the patterns that you create young, they're very hard to shake off. You might be thought of as you were the smart one growing up. And so you might not want to sort of be in that role when you're older. Those grooves are very well worn. And so getting out of those grooves as an adult, it takes some work.
And sometimes you stay in the groove. I was always the messy, sloppy one, and it never changed. Even though in my own house, I'm neat, but I would go home and turn right back into the messy, sloppy
exactly.
one.
And it's not always, I mean, it's not always negative. We're different people with different friends and different family members. So I don't think it's always necessarily negative, although it can be if you're turning into somebody that you don't particularly like.
True. You also quoted Kira Burdett, a senior researcher at the University of Michigan. And she has studied over the years the tension between adult children and their parents. She said 94% in her study reported some kind of strife in their relationship. It goes to say, she especially said, mothers and their daughters are especially fraught. What do you think about this? And what have you learned about this in your research?
I think that conflict is inevitable. Conflict with anyone that you spend that much time with. I don't care how much you love them or who they are. It's just inevitable. Like you, it's hard to live with people. It's hard to, you know, be confronted every day with different personalities and ways of being. And I do think the mother-daughter relationship is the basis of like half of literature.
It's true.
We're never going to get to the bottom of its like depths and its, you know, emotional valences. And it's, you know, I have two daughters. And so I think about it. I think about it all the time. Yeah.
I love how you said conflict is inevitable. And yet I'm sure you've read the statistic that 25% of young adults are estranged from their parents.
Yeah.
You know, why is this taking such a toll?
You know, I don't know. I don't ever want to speak to anyone's specific experience.
No, that's right. That's right.
People, you know, I absolutely know that there are parents out there who are abusive and kids are right to cut them out of their lives. But I also think that sometimes you need to work through conflict that is uncomfortable and unpleasant, and that is ultimately more, will bring you more peace than just completely cutting somebody out of your life.
I agree with you. And I think conflict is inedible. And I think conflict brings people closer.
Yes. Getting through, I mean, really resolving a conflict is an amazing way to really feel like you've been heard and understood.
Exactly.
So I totally agree with you. But it's hard though. It takes a toll. It's easier to just shove it down. And it's, you know, I certainly, there's times where I don't fully explore things that are unpleasant to me and I just sort of deal with them, but you know.
Gotcha. Okay. So your next article you wrote was how to tell your parents you're not joining them for the holidays. And I guess as a parent, I want to say, okay, fine. Do we really expect our kids to join us for every holiday? Why is this an issue?
Yeah, I think some parents can be really unreasonable and not understand that their kids have to have their own lives and their own, especially when they have their own families. Sometimes they need to create their own family rituals and especially like scheduling. I mean, my kids are now in two different schools. Their spring break, one of them has spring break from March 15th. To April 1st. And the other one has spring break.
April 1st to April 12th.
It's like April 22nd. There is not a single day that they, and I'm like, I don't know what the heck I'm going to do about this. And if I had a parent who was like, and you must be here on this day, I would lose my mind because I'm already like, I don't know how we're going to deal with work and all this. So I think there just needs to be open conversation about needs. And I think sometimes if the ritual itself is so, so important, can it happen on a different day? Like, you know, we need to all be flexible about our needs. I think we also need to understand, like, and I actually had this conversation with one of my sister-in-laws. My husband and I had kids first. And long before any of his siblings had children. And I think that there was a feeling, which I totally understand, of mild resentment that everybody was always sort of attending to our needs first, mm-hmm. you know? And so I was glad to have that conversation and say like, you know, you're totally right. We need to come visit you more. It's just about actually having the conversation and the give and take and being somewhat flexible. Because at the end of the day, what do you want? You want to see each other. You want to have family time. Like, shouldn't that be the goal, however it can happen? And so I think it's a shame if you have World War III over, you're not here on this specific day. And I think especially there needs to be a lot of grace in families where there's divorce. And so then there's five different sets of, there's, you know, so many different sets of people to see. Do you need to be driving all day on Christmas Day? So everybody gets and not actually get to stay and enjoy each other's company just because everybody insists on Christmas Day, right?
You're absolutely right. And it's my generation that needs to calm down and understand that.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned or I wrote something about Carl Pilmer wrote this. He told me about, and I've mentioned this in other I think it's intergenerational state. Our generation has a greater stake in the relationship, whereas your generation is building their own life.
Yeah.
You have a great care for the relationship. You want to be close. You want to be family, but you're building your own family right now. You end your book with this statement. We can't just shed several lifetimes of cultural conditioning in one fluid motion, but we can start listening to ourselves. What does that mean to you for both generations of parents?
So I think what that means is, I think especially for mothers, we have a lot of ideas about what we should be doing, not what we want to be doing or what would be best for our families or ourselves, like what the culture wants us to do. And I think we would all do better. And I think this is anyone who is a parent of any child of any age to say, is this something that I am expected to do? Or is this something that actually aligns with my values and what I hope to have, the relationships that I hope to have with my family members? That's my whole kind of philosophy on all relationships.
I love it.
I do think that there are particular pressures on mothers, and I feel them.
So more than fathers?
I think they're different, and I think that they're more intense. And I think that the fathers, the pressures that dads feel are often not about the actual relationships and the day-to-day activities. It's more about, and this is very stereotypical, but we're talking about sort of cultural pressures that are stereotypical. Mm-hmm. I think fathers feel pressure to make money, to provide, to, you know, have, you know, be air quote, you can't see the air quotes, but be men in a very stereotypical mm-hmm. way. And that is not a small pressure. That is a huge pressure. So I'm not diminishing it. But I think in terms of their roles as father, they're not worried about like, oh, is this meal nutritionally perfect? Is the costume for Halloween the perfect costume? Like, I don't think that they have those sort of day-to-day pressures and concerns in the way that most moms feel they are judged on those sorts of aspects.
Interesting. Jessica, at the end of every episode, I always ask my guests to give us two or three takeaways they want our listeners to remember. What would you want to offer our listeners at the end of this interview?
So ambivalence is normal. Ambivalence towards your kids. You're not going to feel amazing about being a parent every second of the day. That's normal. Feeling guilty about it is just a waste of your time. So don't have guilt over feeling guilty. Like, just don't. That, try to not do that. Feel the feelings, work through the feelings, go about your day. Do not feel bad about it. So that's like, that's the really ultimate takeaway of the book. Second takeaway, try to find joy in the moments that you have with your children. I think about this all the time because we're always rushing to and fro. We have so many things to do. They have so many things to do. I have so many things to do. Wherever you can find it. I think I mentioned this in the book as a moment, and I'm just thinking about it because I did it last night. My younger daughter loves cat videos. We can't have cats because my dad's allergic. And I'm actually pretty sure my older daughter's allergic because whenever she sleeps over at someone's house that has a cat, she's scratchy. My younger daughter's obsessed with cats. She loves talking about cats and thinking about cats. So we will just look at cat videos on Instagram and TikTok, and she just laughs and laughs. It brings her so much joy. We're like snuggling together, and it's like such a little thing, right? But it's like, I value it so deeply. So it's just like actually trying to be so present in those moments, enjoy them because they are so fleeting. I feel like I'm like hoarding them, these little like joy moments with my kids. And I know that they're especially, you know, we're not going to have any more kids. And my 7-year-old is kind of getting out of the little kid phase. And so I find it particularly kind of bittersweet to have, kind of, you know, little kid moments with her. So.
Well, Jessica, hoard away. And I really want to thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciated your replying and agreeing to do this because I know you're in hot demand. So I just want to thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Really means a lot. Thank you so much, Jessica. What a smart gal. Although I know we focused quite a bit on young motherhood, there were many takeaways, I think, for all of us. I hope you agree. I particularly like the quote she shared at the beginning. I found out that it was written in 1939 by Catherine McKenzie in the Children and Parents section of the New York Times. So when we think things couldn't get any worse, and we worry about social media, morality, losing respect for religion, elders no longer obeying laws, and so much more, we realize that in 1939, they were talking about some of the same things. Now, if you have time to check out some of Jessica's articles in the New York Times, I think you'll love them. Two that I like in particular are a recent one on the Great American Teacher Crisis and another one that I think is a five-part series on religion. And don't forget about her book, Screaming on the Inside, The Unsustainability of Motherhood in America. It's a great look at the history of motherhood and how we can work together to make it better for all of us. Anyway, thank you all for listening, and thanks again to Connie Gorant Fisher, our audio engineer. And if you enjoyed our podcast, share it with a friend. It really means a lot. And finally, always remember, sometimes you may have to bite your tongue.